En Camino with Kit Hogg.
In these interesting and troubled times in which we live, I wonder if your relationship with the news has changed at all. How often do you watch, listen, or read the news? And from what source do you get it? Are you exposing yourself to more news than before? There's certainly more of it about, and far greater choice of media from which to choose. And here's the thing. Do you ever wonder if the diet of news that you consume is doing you any good? Does the drip of news into your life increase anxiety, and would you be happier without it? As happy, indeed, as this morning's guest, Terence Michaels, our resident sage of the Serenea. Terry, good morning to you.
Good morning, Kit, and thank you for that kind introduction. Oh, lovely to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. Terry, you embarked on a news fast some months ago. What is a news fast, and how did this regime occur?
Well, it is what it says on the tin. It's a complete denial, rejection of all forms of news, all forms of current affairs, all forms of punditry, anything vaguely polemical. A rest from the constant input of what I would say is a very nasty old gossip that's got nothing to say good about anybody and just fills your heart and mind with misery. So, yeah, I think that's a pretty good reason to give it a new fast.
Right, that's fairly comprehensive. And what benefits have you noticed from cutting out the news?
They are manifold. Yeah, I think one thing, a peculiar thing, is better dreams. I know that sounds crazy, but I think if you're subjected to a constant diet of the sort of news that we get, which is invariably bad and horrible, you know, it's going to affect you. Whether you think it is or not, it's going to have an effect upon you. And so I think looking back, I realized that I was in a constant state of low-level adrenal stimulation. A vague and indefinable anxiety, and it's gone. And I think partly that's due to my diet, we've spoken about that before, but largely I think it's due to an absence of this constant input, as I say, of this rather nasty old gossip.
Let me bring in Mary Carmen, our producer, who's sitting next door. MC, what's your relationship with the news? Are you a news junkie? Do you have it on all the time? Do you know what's going on?
No, it's the same as Terry. Basically, I am news fasting all the time, since years and years, I think. I don't see news. I don't watch TV.
Do you not? Do you not watch TV?
No, I only watch series and YouTube videos, but no news. I don't read newspapers.
Right. Was there ever a time that you listened to the news?
Yeah, when I was studying my degree in communication, I had to be updated. But what I have learned from there to here is that I don't believe a single thing that they put in the TV or in the internet or any. I just don't believe what I don't see and I don't hear. So doesn't have a value for me.
Okay, so go on, Terry.
Sorry, as you say, we sing from the same song sheet there, I think. Well done, Mary Carmen. What good does it do you?
So but what you brought in here is a whole other facet, the facet of distrust of the source. Do you inherently distrust the source, Terry?
Absolutely. I think it started for me listening to things like the Today programme and other BBC output, and particularly this is not my first news fast. I go back to 2004 with the oncoming Iraqi war and listening to the output from the BBC. And I'd heard one day from a different source that there was 50,000 people demonstrating against the war outside broadcasting house of the BBC. And do you know, on the BBC, there was not even a mention of it, nothing. It set me thinking, well, if these people are not telling me about this, the demonstration outside their front door, what else aren't they telling me? And it triggered in me this realization that it's all curated, Kit. It's all mediated through the eyes and ears of people who want you to believe a particular agenda. And even people with the best will in the world have a point of view, and they're going to put that point of view across, and that may not be an accurate global viewpoint. So, it isn't the first time I've stopped. I don't know how I slipped back into it, but I'm so glad now that I have cut it all out again. And I think I'll continue now.
Mary Coleman, is there not a danger of you living in a burbuja, in a bubble? Like if you're not looking, you're not listening to the news, you're not that somehow the overall awareness of what's going on. For example, the Valencia floods. How did you find out about them, and when did you find out about them?
I found out like 3 days later by Anna Glowinski here in the office, and she told me, and I said, what's going on in Valencia? And she said, what?
Yeah.
But you know what?
It's similar for me.
Sorry,
it's similar for me. I heard nothing, and then 3 days later, somebody sent me some videos on their WhatsApp, a friend who lives in that part of the world, and that's the first I knew of it. I would say, Kit, you know, that you are informed whether you like it or not. It trickles through, and anything genuine important, you'll certainly hear about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's just go back to the source of your news. Let's pretend that you are, prior to your news fast, the beginning of your news fast, Terry, you mentioned that you actually started watching Al Jazeera because you felt that their news was potentially less lopsided, that you trusted that source more.
Marginally more, as I don't trust any of them, Kit. I'm very calm on that. But no, I downloaded the app, and in the mornings I was looking at the news, and every day it was about basically how many poor Palestinian children had their legs and arms blown off. And I realised after a few days that it was depressing me enormously. It was filling me with anxiety. And the worst of it, Kit, was the sense of impotence, the realisation that I could watch it all day long and that would not save the life of one Palestinian child, not the life of one Ukrainian soldier. There was nothing I could do to ameliorate these appalling situations. All I could do was absorb it in a sort of voyeuristic manner and just feel miserable and actually add to the sum total of human misery. I suggest this, Kit, that if millions of us were watching this, we're all getting miserable and depressed, and we're unable to do anything about it. So what's the point? You know, let's turn to something more positive and add to the positivity in the world and reduce some of the negativity.
So why are we so obsessed with the news? Why do people... the news comes on, well, on this radio station, for example, every hour we have a news bulletin. And this radio station is not alone. Mary Coleman?
No, they're all like that.
Mary Coleman wants to come in?
No, I think from my point of view, we are not addicted to news. We are addicted to the stimulation that the news gives us. It doesn't matter if it is a good or a bad stimulation. I think the high that you get because you... that powerlessness gives you an emotional punch. That's what... is addictive, in my opinion. That's what I think.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for that. And is I think, egregious how hour after... And this is, I think, where the particular issue, Kit, is that it's one thing to listen maybe to the news once a week and get a rough idea of what's going on in the world, and it will be a rough idea and a very selective idea. But it's another thing to listen every hour to this constant input of misery and negativity. It's brainwashing. And even if you're an intelligent person and think you're filtering it out, you're not. It's still going in. By the end of the day, you'll have heard the same thing over and over, and it will be something horrible. And do you need it in your life? And is it helping anybody? No, it isn't.
Yeah. I think that's kind of what you're referring to there is sort of background chat or static. It's like going into a bar and there's a TV on and there's just news circulating. You know, when they show you the same film over and over again of some unfortunate being led out of the house handcuffed by the Guardia Civil or something. That, for me, is passivity. It's wallpaper. At its most obsessive, though, or you have used the word voyeurism, I think it becomes a kind of feeding frenzy, the obsession with other with some misfortune that's going on.
But it can do damage, Kit. I think of my dear late friend Steve, for instance. I mentioned to you in a recent conversation how he'd heard many years ago, long before the current conflict between Russia and Ukraine, that how there was inevitability of nuclear war between the two countries. And he went out, he bought all these tins of food, he bought sacks of oats, he barricaded himself in his house, utterly convinced through the brainwashing of the media that he was just about to get blown into little pieces. Of course, it was absolute nonsense. But so it isn't something that's merely peripheral. It can be fundamental to people's life and well-being and to their mental health. Steve was absolutely addicted to the adrenaline he got from the negative news, and you just saw him go grey with it, but he couldn't drop it. Very, very sad.
What do you? What would you both say to somebody who said that not knowing what's going on? Like, for example, Mali Kahneman, it took you 3 days before you were aware of the tragedy in Valencia, which actually isn't that far away. Mm. What would you say to someone who called you irresponsible?
I'm not well, I say, why do you say that to me? That doesn't make sense. I'm responsible of my mental health, so I'm taking care of my mental health. That's very responsible.
But if we're kind of like a global village, if we're all kind of like somehow one, is it not incumbent upon you as a conscious human being to be aware of the news? Not in every kind of nitty-gritty dramatic aspect, but major events.
Well, I don't know. I don't think I am irresponsible. I am just free to choose not to hear in things that I don't believe.
Yeah, no.
Sorry, Terry.
I'd argue the other way. No, sorry, it's difficult here. I'd argue the other way, Kit, that it's not necessarily a responsible thing to fill your head with what is likely to be misinformation anyway, or at least a very, very partial viewpoint. I mentioned the BBC earlier was a particularly good example. You know, but do you remember recently in the COVID pandemic here? I think this is a good example that there was an awful lot of censorship going on. There was a party line. You stuck to that narrative, and if you attempted to move away from that narrative, you were vilified, sacked, mocked, etc., etc. The rights and wrongs was one side, but where was the media was just guilty of providing this kind of mind. Mind meld. You say we're one community, Kit, but there should be room within that for discussion. And there wasn't in that case. The news in that case was extraordinarily biased and one-sided. And any attempt to say otherwise was the same, met with vilification, disgust, anger. You lose your job, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and that brings us back to trusting the source, doesn't it? And
I think that time did a lot of damage to the trust, of not just amongst in me, but in an awful lot of people. I think a lot of people sort of compared their personal experience to what they were seeing on the news and realised that they're tooed in jail.
COVID was an extraordinary situation, though, wasn't it? Nobody really knew what was going on. Mm. You know, whether it was nemesis of the human race
all the more important, there, Kit, to have open and free discussion, which was simply not allowed. So, I mean, that's one part. I know we're not wandering a little bit for the news here, but that's another complication with the media. You know, it was an agenda of fear. It was be afraid, be very afraid. And so much of the news is exactly that. And as I say, I would argue that you're actually being more responsible stepping away from it and stepping away from this a constant agenda of fear.
If we are going to listen to the news, though, I think one has to accept that complete objectivity is impossible. I mean, but between the three of us, we would witness the same event, and we're bound to relate it in three different ways, three different emphases. It's natural if you're the punter to choose a source that you think might be empathetic with our opinions. It might be YouTube, it might be Fox News, it might be El País, In apprehending the information that they report, isn't it vital to allow for their political standpoint and to judge their credibility from that prism? I mean, which argues for a sense of instinct, isn't it? And I'm not arguing, I'm not saying that your newsfast isn't a bad thing, but most of us will receive news in one form or another, and I'm just looking for a blueprint for that. It's kind of it is an instinctive thing, isn't it?
It is, of course. So you get the news you want to hear. That's part of the internet, the world these days. Let me just mention something here briefly. Do you know that if in the summer of 1939 you'd been in Germany, you would have been utterly convinced that Poland was just about to invade and there was no choice but you invade them first. And you've been utterly convinced of that. The media was, every single German newspaper was pumping out this image. Millions of people believed something that simply wasn't true. And I'd say that's perhaps an extreme example, but it gives you an idea of the power of the media and how everybody sticking to one party line can be extraordinarily dangerous. We need plurality, and so much of the media shuts down that plurality. I mean, if you look at, for instance, the tabloid press in the UK, fortunately hasn't been subjected to this, I hope, but papers like the Mail, and the Mirror and the Sun and so forth, you know, with outrageous headlines that are designed to create the maximum hate and division between people. How can that be news? How can that be something that you'd want to absorb?
Yeah, and related to that, what you say, Terry, about hate and everything, there was a time when I was very polarized on my opinion. This was a few years ago already. Mm-hmm. And all the news I consumed was to feed my polarized opinion. And I always found news to feed this hate. Always. Yeah. Always. Yeah. There was a place where I could read and think that it was true. Now, I was in that bubble myself, and because I was in that's really a bubble. I don't feel that where I am now is a bubble.
It's very wise of you, Marie Carmen, to have burst out of that bubble and to look around. Yeah,
that's a very dangerous thing. Now I don't feel, I just say, okay, I don't believe anything they tell me. I have to see with my eyes. And I'm very, very interested in local news, for example, I don't know, about my town hall, about my neighborhood.
It's relevant to you, personally relevant to you, yeah. And I think you're very wise, Marie Carmen, to say what you said about mental health, really. In the end of the day, it's about protecting your mental health. And I'd say this nasty old gossip with its constant input of negativity is damaging your mental health. Even if you think it's not, it is.
It is. Cut it out.
That brings me on to my next point, Marie Carmen, what you said. Yeah. You take the news out of your life. But at what level, at what distance from where you're impacted by it, do you let it back in? You've just referred to local events.
Yeah.
That presumably impact on you. That's the sort of news that you admit into your life. Am I right or not?
Yeah, so, for example, if they are opening a new, I don't know, I think 1 year they wanted to open a skate ice place in San Pedro for skating.
Yeah.
I want to know those things because I want to go. So something that doesn't make me feel powerless. Something that I can't, or if I know that there is somebody poisoning the dogs in the neighborhood, then I have the power to not take the dog over there. But if they tell me that, I don't know how many children are already dying in Palestine, what the hell can I do? Mm-hmm. It's very desolating, and it's really sad that I cannot do anything, but the truth is that I can't.
That's exactly my point. I respect what you're saying enormously there.
Mm.
Kit, to answer your question about not being informed, I was chatting to a friend yesterday, and she takes a paper called The Week, and it's a once-a-week roundup of various stories from various media outputs, you know, various newspapers and so forth. And I would say that's about the right level. You know, you can be informed, but you don't have to tickle yourself in it. You can perhaps once a week have a quick glance at what's going on. You're perfectly well informed, and without the constant input and stress of the horrible negativity every hour.
Yes, it's a periodical, isn't it? And it gives a review and it gives a perspective. But I can also see the appeal of, well, if we're talking about the press, I can see the appeal of buying a red top, say we're back in Blighty, to read on the bus or read on the underground or whatever. You know, it's about selling papers. It's about entertaining as much as anything, as much as the news, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. I mentioned, Kit, to you about the yellow press at the end of the 19th century in America. There was a fire in a theatre and nobody got hurt. A reporter was sent and he reported that people were burned and other people were pickpocketing other people, like the Hillsborough disaster, this sort of thing. And total misinformation, because he realised that people don't really want good news, you know, that they get a buzz from the bad stuff. And so he made up all this stuff. And I'd say that tradition continues, and it's disturbing, it's worrying. It's not the truth. You're not getting the truth through the news. You're getting a version of it, and some of it absolutely made up.
So let's just leave this topic with a scenario. It's difficult to imagine the 21st century. It's probably almost as easy to imagine that money was abolished. But it would certainly be more of a reality, say, 500 years ago. What if there was no reported news? How might that alter the event that would otherwise be news? Because there's no question that, particularly in the political world, events are tailored for news. You've only got to look at, for example, the recent US elections to see that.
Yeah, I mean, is it news, Kit? I mean, basically, it's the same old stuff regurgitated with a slightly different cast of characters. You know, it's the same old stuff. Anyway, it's not really news anyway. But yeah, I mean, it's difficult to imagine a scenario, as you say, where there's no news. But I think Marie Carmen's all right. You'd get the local news that way. It wouldn't be crowded out by all this international stuff about which you can do absolutely nothing.
Mm.
Yeah, it's good to be informed, Kit, but are you actually informed by listening to a news bulletin every hour? And I say you're not. You're misinformed. 100%. And you're miserable because of it.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
Well, great to chat to you guys. I'd just like to, this question of no news and no reported news, I'd like to leave this discussion with a Zen saying: in the event of no news, if a tree falls in a forest and no one is there to hear it, does it even make a sound?
No, it makes vibrations in the air. There's no sound where there are no ears. There's no light where there are no eyes.
So if there's no reporting, possibly there's no news. We're going to leave it there. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with Terence Michaels on something completely different after these messages.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Hello and welcome back. This is the long chat on En Camino. I'm graced with the company of Terence Michaels and Marie Carmen, my producer. So it's very nice. And very nice to have you here too. Now, there are a few ways of getting to know another human being, quite like the experience of being locked in a small room together with a laboratory for some 20 hours a day, when that other human being translates initially into the choiceless company of a complete stranger and an overriding influence on one's already parlous state of mind when deprived of freedom. Jail is one of the few situations that offers this opportunity, and here to talk about cellmates that may or may not become soulmates, I'm privileged to have Terence Michaels here. Terry, hi man, and
hello,
and thank you for agreeing to talk about this. I mean, there's no two ways of beating about it. You've been inside and you've shared a room with various different people, and I want to know what it's like, and with some examples, please. Do you want to talk to us?
Yeah, surely. I'm an old lad, who I was. Have you ever seen Porridge, Kit?
Yeah,
with Bonnie Barker.
Absolutely.
That is the most accurate description prison life I've ever seen. In a Victorian prison, such as the one I was in Norwich, with you know, the brown walls and the horrible noises and the smells, etc., etc. But we go back to April the 17th, I think it was, in 1980, and it was my first sentence. I would like to point out to the listener that this is always for cannabis and not for any. I've not robbed, stolen, murdered, or hurt anybody in any way, and cannabis should be legal, but that's beside the point. On the night of the 17th of April 1980, I spent my first night in a British prison cell. And earlier in the evening, there was a guy in there called Frank, sharing with an old man called Frank, who had a rather unpleasant habit of rubbing his hands together in glee whenever a prison officer asked him to make him a cup of tea. But
what?
That's beside the point now.
Let's rewind here. So the prison officer comes into your cell and says, Frank, make me a cup of tea. Is that what's going on?
No, yeah, he was an orderly. You know, they had red armbands, and he'd done many, many years and was completely broken by the system. So, you know, he's a...
he was sort of lackey.
Lackey, in effect, yeah, and difficult to, not to sympathise with somebody been broken by the system. But anyway, on the first night, he kept insisting. He thought, oh, you're in for drugs, take this pill. And in the end, tired of him insisting upon it, I pretended to take it. I pretended to swallow it, and during the night, after a couple of hours, I could feel my sheets being lifted up. And I was wide awake. I couldn't sleep. I mean, it was my first night in prison. I spun around and said, what is going on? And poor Frank, he's a sad character. He pretended he was fumbling around. Oh, he'd lost his matches. But obviously, he thought he'd knocked me out and he was going to have his evil way with me. So that was my very first introduction. And I have to say, possibly the very worst experience in several years of subsequent prison experience. It wasn't quite so bad.
Does beg the question of homosexuality in these cells? I mean, it was
extremely rare, Kim.
Okay.
Rare. So, a medium myth. Most people are so keen on establishing their heterosexuality that even if you accidentally touch somebody, it's, oh, sorry, mate, because people are very frightened of that frightened of that. And I met one guy, this was in Ford prison years later, and he said, look, it's the worst place to be because nobody wants to know. It's surrounded by men and nobody wants to know. So it's not ideal. Yeah, right. So it's like so many myths about prisons. That's one of the most egregious.
All right, so let's set the scene. A typical cell. I mean, you've been inside in Blighty and in here in Spain. But can
Holland.
You paint a... in Holland as well, yeah?
Briefly,
right, okay.
They didn't like me much in Holland. They sent me back to England.
So yeah, just for those of us who haven't been inside a prison cell, what could we expect to find and what sort of dimension are we talking?
Tiny kit. I mean, I never actually measured it. I suppose I could walk 3 or 4 steps one way and 2 or 3 steps the other way in any cell. I mean, the Victorian ones in Britain were designed for one person, and there were 3 of us in there, including a Rasta man who I mentioned, who insisted or asked me to write his letters for him. He couldn't read or write, and that was really funny because each letter was completely different depending on whether it was one for his wife, one for his parents, or one for his blood clot mates. Very amusing. And there's a lot of that going on, you know, a lot of people presenting themselves in different ways to different people, understandably.
And there's inevitably there's a lavatory in the cell.
There was, not in the British one. No. I mean, of course I'm going back a long time, kid, but we did slopping out, which meant one of the 3 of us had to take this bucket full of urine and splash it out into the communal toilets early in the morning. So the horrific smells are horrible.
Oh,
and if
God.
People wanted to do a poo, they did it in a newspaper and chugged it out the window.
Oh,
somebody
really?
Had the job of going around the courtyard in the morning, clearing up all the packaged poo and sat on the patio. But Spanish prison had the decency at least to provide you with a little sort of stainless steel toilet in the corner. And much, much better.
But no privacy.
No whatsoever. In fact, just right at the end of my last sentence, the European Union is insisting that the curtains were put across to give some privacy to the prisoner. And they were fitting curtains as I was leaving, and curtains on the windows as well, which previously there weren't any. But no, these places are horrible, kid. I mean, it's a cold concrete box, basically. And... not in any way salubrious. Should I go on a bit, Kit, about some of the people I'd love you to.
I was going to ask if you have any choice, you know, whether you can pair up with somebody, you know, so did you want to come and share with me or something, or whether you're just lumped together.
Well, it depends on how well you're getting on with the funcionarios or the prison warders. In English prison, no choice whatsoever, but in Spanish, if you found somebody who had some sort of connection with you, could invite them into your cell. But that was extremely rare. Yeah. And it could go wrong. I think I mentioned about Victor the Vanquished. He was a young Nigerian chap who could speak English. So I thought, well, I'll have him in my cell when the previous inmate left. And it turned out that he had some horrible intestinal disease that meant he stunk to high heaven. And if you can imagine being in a tiny box with somebody who smells of intestines, basically, then, not pleasant at all.
Oh, so that Victor backfired. That's
literally, yeah. Yeah. But I mean, that was one of the worst cases. I mean, it's not all bad. I mean, in Puerto de Santurce, there was a terrible occasion with a guy who'd gone catatonic. He'd spent a year on remand. He'd got a letter saying he had another year to go, and he hadn't even been charged. It just drove him mad. And the chap I shared the cell with, we took turns staying awake to keep an eye on this guy. He'd gone catatonic. He just stared at the walls, or occasionally jumped up and ran from one end of the cell to the other, screaming. And we were genuinely worried for our safety.
Mm.
So that was particularly horrible. And another time I was locked up with a Ugandan transvestite. It was on my first night back in 2011. And that also was a particularly... Not that there's anything awful about him being a transvestite, but he played this horribly loud radio constantly. And in the end, I absolutely snapped. And I tell you, man, it's the first time I've ever seen terror in somebody's eyes when I pinned him to the wall. Small as I am, I'd reach my limit, you know, so it can go that way. It can be dangerous.
It must be a huge strain on human relationships. And because of, as I mentioned, the sort of parlous state of one's sanity anyway, and the emotions that you're going through when deprived of your liberty, to then have to mix that with relating to another person. I said 20 hours a day. Is that real? I mean, are you together for that long? Or
Well, when I was in Norwich prison, this was there was a warden strike, and it was actually 23 and a half hours a day, and just half an hour to slop out, really. That was particularly bad. But no, Spanish prison, given the choice, I'd take Spanish prison any day. You have several hours a day of going out and mixing with other prisoners if you choose to do so. And in fact, I generally didn't. I prefer to stay in my cell. It's better to be locked in than amongst the rest of the population. For the last 2 years of my sentence in the 90s, a very decent functionario could see what was happening to me. I'd been in this gypsy modulo for 3 years in total, and it was driving me absolutely insane. I had a succession of insane gitanos living with me, and many of them illiterate and with no conversation whatsoever. And I mean, one guy, for instance, I remember he used to glue himself to the floor in hot weather and insist I didn't put my reading lamp on because it made the cell even hotter. So yeah, you're quite right. It really does add an additional strain to something that is already absolutely boiling up.
Did you say glue himself to the floor?
Yeah, basically, yeah. During the night, he'd get out of his bed and he'd lay as much of his body stuck on the concrete floor as possible to try and lose some heat.
Okay.
Very strange story. I mean, you do meet some strange things. I have to say, I mean, dear listener, don't think that this is all bad, because you meet some wonderful people too, and, people who just made mistakes or drunk drivers, people like that. Not necessarily evil people. On the contrary, very rare.
What's the best cellmate you've had? Is there a relationship that is there are there moments that stand out where you're really getting on?
Yeah, there is. I referred to a chap called Simon Brackenbury. I don't suppose he's listening. But, we were a couple of months together in a cell, and we used to joke some nights that had they come and let us out, we'd just stay in because we were having too much of a laugh. playing Monopoly or whatever, you were playing your Cluedo or whatever it was in a cell. So, yeah, it's not all bad. And we used to say, look, come on, hurry up. We don't want to be here all night.
So the fact that you haven't been in touch with him would indicate that you're not in touch with any of your cellmates. No cellmate has become a soulmate, so to speak.
Not anymore. No, there was a little, there was an English guy called Derek, who his story was absolutely fascinating, how he'd been conned into shifting 500 keys by kilos of hashish by a woman called Carmen Peretta. Perhaps we shouldn't go into that. But tales of dirty doing, and I maintained contact with him for many years, but he died. So,
is it normal to lodge people who've gone down for the same kind of crime together?
No, not at all. Not at all. You're just all thrown into
right. a hodgepodge, really. Okay.
And you don't know. I mean, I've spent nights with a guy who murdered a functionario, and he was going to spend the rest of his life in prison. I felt no personal risk at all. I wasn't a functionario. And I've said many times, kid, that these places, you take into them what you find. If you're an angry and aggressive person, you'll find anger and aggression there, for sure. If you're a peaceful person who just wants to get on, then that's what you'll find as well. Peace.
I would imagine, though, that it's impossible not to bring angst with you in that situation.
Yeah,
self-recrimination, fear, intense frustration,
boredom,
okay.
Boredom.
Yeah, I guess boredom becomes the overriding feature, once the initial emotion is worn off, you're left with boredom, I guess. Yeah,
you are. And as Cervantes said at the beginning of Don Quixote, he wrote that in prison, and he said you are surrounded by dismal noises. The dismal noises, the sounds of keys and clanging steel doors and people shrieking, and it's round the clock, and that's particularly depressing. You can rise above these things. Indeed.
Well, you evidently have, and you're an example to us all, Terence.
Well, thank you. Example to get logged up now.
No, the fact that you're...
I do want to re-emphasise. I just want to re-emphasise that I've bought and sold cannabis all my life, and I've paid a high price for it, but I don't feel I've done any moral wrong, and... I wouldn't be speaking like this, Kit, if I'd murdered somebody or stolen something from somebody or something like this.
Would you describe yourself as tempered but unscarred by your prison experiences?
I don't know if that's entirely Yeah, I wouldn't say entirely unscarred. You know, if you take a heavy weight and you put it on a piece of foam, when you lift that weight off, the foam bounces back. But if you leave that weight on there too many years, the foam doesn't bounce back. And I think that's partly what happens to you, to use that as an example, that you never really fully recover from the intensity of depression that you experience after 2, 3, 4 years.
Yeah.
You never fully recover. No.
The imprint.
On the other hand, every morning I wake up and if I'm feeling a little bit miserable, I think I'm not in prison, and suddenly I feel great. It's perspective, you know. If you thought waiting 5 minutes for a bus was a long time, you'd try waiting 4 years for one.
absolutely.
You learn patience.
Yeah. Well, reasons to be cheerful. Terence Michael said, tell me.
One last thing. You do, as I say, meet some fascinating characters. I met my last cellmate ever was a guy whose face looked exactly like a picture of the moon. He had a sticking out chin and a sticking out forehead and a sort of concave face. And he looked like the man in the moon. You know, there's pictures of the man in the moon. And he was in for stabbing his girlfriend. She was in another prison for stabbing him. And I wrote the letters for them. He apologised to her and he got letters back. She apologised to him. So, you know, very drunk, of course. They were drunk at the time.
The man in the moon. And the woman in the moon.
The woman of the man in the moon.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then he was, I mean, sober. He was, I don't know what he was like, drunk, awful probably, but as a young man, sober, he was pleasant company.
So they made up. Let's hope they're having a lovely time together.
Yeah. Well, it's only 10 years ago, so possibly so. Yeah, well, 12 years ago now. Yeah. Let's hope so. And I would say, please, you know, if you've got an attitude towards people in prison, they should suffer. Believe me, losing your freedom is suffering enough, and it's an indefinable, awful thing. You can't put your finger on it until you've lost it. When you've lost it, it hurts.
Yeah, no, the mind boggles for those of us who haven't done it. Terry, we're going to have to leave it there, man, because we've run out of time. Thank you so much for being on En Camino today. It's been fascinating.
A great pleasure, Kit, as always, and thank you so much for inviting me.
But,
and thank you, Marie Carmen, for agreeing with me. Bless your heart.
You're welcome, Terry.
All right, from us. Oh, yeah. Bye-bye, Terry.
Bye-bye, Kit. Bye-bye, listener. Bye-bye, Marie Carmen. Bye.